You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled From Jesus to Christ. This is Lecture 5. When you recall that in the course of our lectures, we have come to look upon the Christ impulse as the most profound event of human evolution, you will, doubtless, consider that some exertion of mental power is needed to understand its full meaning, its full extent. We certainly find the bad habit widely spread of saying that the highest things in the world must be made comprehensible in the simplest way. If what anyone is constrained to say of the sources of existence appears complicated, people turn away from him because, quote, the truth must be simple, close quote. In the long run, it certainly is simple. But if at a certain stage we wish to learn to know the highest things, it is not hard to see that we must first clear the way to understanding them. And in order from a definite point of view to find ourselves in the presence of the full greatness, the full significance of the Christ impulse, we must bring together many and different matters. We need only turn to the Pauline epistles, and we shall soon see that Paul, who sought especially to incorporate into human development the supersensible nature of the Christ being, that Paul has gathered together into the concept, into the idea of the Christ, the whole, so to speak, of human evolution. It is certain that if we let the Pauline epistles work upon us, we have finally something which, through its extraordinary simplicity and through the deeply penetrating quality of the words and sentences, makes a most significant impression. But this is the case only because Paul, through his own initiation, had worked himself up to that simplicity, which is not the starting point of what is true, but the consequence, the goal. When we wish to penetrate into that which Paul was able, finally, to express in wonderful, monumental, simple words concerning the Christ being, we must approach in our theosophic way by an understanding of human nature, for the further development of which, upon the earth, the Christ impulse came. Let us consider, therefore, what we already know concerning human nature as it meets us through occult sight. We divide the life of man into two parts, and look upon them according to the course of time. The period between birth and death, and the period which runs its course between death and a new birth. Let us first of all place man before us in his physical body. We know that occult sight sees him as a fourfold being, but as a fourfold being in process of development. Occult sight sees the physical body, etheric body, astral body, and the ego. We know that in order to understand human evolution, we must make ourselves acquainted with the occult truth that this ego, of which we become aware in our feelings and perceptions when we simply look away from the external world and try to look into ourselves, that this ego, for occult sight, goes on from incarnation to incarnation. But we also know that this ego is, as it were, ensheathed. Although ensheathed is not a good expression, we can use it at present. The ego is ensheathed by three other members of human nature, the astral body, the etheric body, and the physical body. Of the astral body, we know that in a certain respect, it is the companion of the ego through the various incarnations. For though during the Kamaloka time much of the astral body must be shed, it remains to us during the incarnation time as a kind of power body, which holds together what we have stored up of moral, intellectual, and aesthetic progress during an incarnation. What constitutes true progress is held together through the power of the astral body, is carried from one incarnation to another, and is, as it were, linked together with the ego, which passes as the fundamentally eternal in us from incarnation to incarnation. Further, we know that from the etheric body, too, very much is cast off immediately after death, but that an extract of this etheric body also remains to us, an extract which we take with us from one incarnation to another. It is actually as follows. In the first days, directly after death, we have a kind of review, like a great tableau of our life up to that time, and we take with us as etheric result the extract, the concentration of this review. The rest of the etheric body is given over into the general etheric world, in one form or the other, according to the development of the person in question. When, however, we direct our gaze to the fourth member of the human being, to the physical body, it seems at first as if the physical body simply disappears in the physical world. One might say this can be externally demonstrated in the physical world, for to external sight this physical body is brought in one way or another to dissolution. The question, however, which everyone who occupies himself with theosophy must put to himself is the following. Is not, perhaps, all that external physical cognition can tell us about the fate of our physical body only Maya? The answer does not really lie very far away for him who has begun to understand theosophy. When a man has begun to understand theosophy, so that he can say, quote, all that is offered by sense appearance is Maya, is external illusion, close quote, how can he continue to think it is really true that the physical body, delivered over to the grave or to the fire, disappears without a trace, even when the experience obtrudes itself ever so crudely? Perhaps behind the external Maya, which obtrudes itself for the evidence of the senses, there lies something much deeper. Let us go somewhat deeper. Let us remember that in order to understand the evolution of the earth, we must know the earlier embodiments of our planet. We must study the Saturn, Sun, and Moon embodiments of the earth. We know that the earth has gone through its, in quotes, incarnations, just as each human being has done. That which is our physical body was prepared in human evolution from the Saturn period of the earth. During the ancient Saturn time, we cannot speak at all of our etheric body, astral body, and ego in the sense of the present day. But the germ for the physical body was already sown, was embodied during the Saturn evolution. During the Sun period of the earth, this germ was transformed, and then in this germ, in its altered form, the etheric was embodied. During the Moon period of the earth, the physical body was again transformed, and in it, and at the same time in the etheric body, which also came forth in an altered form, the astral body was incarnated. During the Earth period, the ego was incorporated, and is it conceivable that the sense phenomenon is correct, that that part of us which was embodied during the Saturn period, our physical body, simply decomposes or is burned up and disappears into the elements, after the most significant efforts had been made throughout millions and millions of years, during the Saturn, Sun, and Moon periods, by supersensible, by divine spiritual beings, in order to produce it, that is, this physical body? If this were true, we should have the very remarkable fact before us that through four, or if you will, three planetary stages, Saturn, Sun, Moon, a whole host of divine beings, work to produce a cosmic element such as our physical body is, and that this cosmic element is destined during the Earth period to vanish every time a person dies. It would be a remarkable drama if Maya, and external observation knows nothing else, were to be right. Now we ask, can Maya be right? At first it certainly seems as though occult knowledge declares Maya to be correct. But strangely enough, occult knowledge seems in this case to harmonize with Maya. When we study what is described by theosophical knowledge as the development of man after death, we find in this description that notice is hardly taken of the physical body. We are told that the physical body is thrown off, is given over to the elements of the earth. We are told of the etheric body, of the astral body, of the ego. The physical body is not further touched upon, and it seems as if through the silence of theosophical knowledge, assent were given to Maya knowledge. So it seems. And in a certain way we are justified by theosophy in speaking thus, for the simple reason that everything further must be left to the deeper, more thorough establishment by means of Christology. For concerning what goes beyond Maya, in reference to the physical body, we cannot speak at all correctly without having had a sufficient explanation beforehand of the Christ impulse and all that is connected with it. If we observe how this physical body stood at some definite moment before the consciousness of man, we shall reach a quite remarkable result. Let us inquire, in a definite epoch of human development, into three kinds of folk consciousness, into three different forms of human consciousness possessed by man, concerning all that is connected with our physical body. Let us inquire first of all among the Greeks. We know that the Greeks were that remarkable people which had its period of evolution in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch of civilization. We know that this fourth post-Atlantean epoch of civilization began about the 8th century before our era, and that it ended in the 13th, 14th, and 15th centuries after the event of Palestine. We can easily confirm what is said in reference to this period by external information, that is, by traditions and documents. The first dimly clear accounts concerning Greece hardly go further back than the 6th or 7th century before our era. Legendary accounts, however, come down to us from still earlier times. We know that that which constitutes the greatness of the historical period of Greece comes down from the preceding period, vis-à-vis the third post-Atlantean epoch. The inspired productions of Homer reach back into the period preceding the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, and Aeschylus, who lived so early that a number of his works have been lost, points back to the drama of the Mysteries, of which he offers us but an echo. The third post-Atlantean civilization period comes over into the Greek Age. The fourth post-Atlantean period comes to full expression in that age. The wonderful Greek culture is the purest expression of the fourth post-Atlantean age of civilization. Now, there falls upon our ear a remarkable saying from this land of Greece, a saying which permits us to see deeply into the soul of the man who felt himself truly a Greek, the saying of the hero, quote, "Better a beggar in the upper world than a king in the land of shades," close quote. Footnote, editor's note, the quotation is from the Odyssey. Achilles says to Odysseus, who has for his own reasons gone down into Hades, quote, "Do not try to make out a case for being dead, noble Odysseus. I should prefer to be a poor man's serf on the earth than to rule over all the dead, outworn." Close quote. End of footnote. That is a saying which betrays the deep susceptibility of the Greek soul. It might be said that all that has been preserved to us from Greece of classic beauty and classic greatness, of the gradual formation of the human ideal in the external world, all this, in a certain way, resounds to us from this saying. Let us recall that wonderful training of the human body in Greek gymnastics, in the great Greek games, which are only caricatured in these days by persons who have not the slightest idea of what Greece really was. We should take into consideration the fact that every period has its own ideal, if we want to understand how this development of the external physical body, as it stands there in its own form upon the physical plane, was a peculiar privilege of the Greek spirit. Further, the creation for humanity of ideals in plastic art, the raising to such a height of the human form and sculpture, was likewise a privilege of the Greek spirit. And when, in addition to this, we look upon the development of the human consciousness as, for example, it held sway in a Pericles, when man, on the one hand, could form a concept of what was common to man, and on the other hand, and within the domain of his city, could stand on his own feet and feel himself lord and king. When we let all this work upon us, then we must say that the real love of the Greek was expended on the human form as it stood there before him on the physical plane, and that aesthetics too were turned to account in the development of this form. Where that which stood before man on the physical plane was so loved and understood, one could give one's self up to the thought, quote, when that which gives to man this beautiful form on the physical plane is taken away from human nature, one cannot value what is left as highly as that which is taken away in death. Close quote. This supreme love for the external form led of necessity to a pessimistic view of what is left over from man when he has passed through the gate of death. And we can fully understand that the Greek soul, whose eye, EYE, looked with so great a love upon the outer form, felt sad when compelled to think, quote, this form is taken away from the human individuality. The human individuality lives on without this form. Close quote. If, for the present, one looks at it solely from the point of view of feeling, then one must say, we have in Greece that branch of the human race which loved and valued the human body the most, and underwent the deepest sorrow which could be endured when it perished in death. And now, let us consider another consciousness which developed about the same time, the Buddha consciousness, which had passed from Buddha into his followers. There we have before us almost the opposite of what we found in Greece. We need only remember one thing, the kernel of the four great truths of Buddha, which is that human individuality is brought by longing, by desire, into this existence in which it is enshrouded by the external physical form. Into what kind of existence? Into an existence described in the Buddha teaching as follows, quote, birth is sorrow, sickness is sorrow, old age is sorrow, death is sorrow, close quote. The underlying thought in this kernel of Buddhism is that by being enshrouded in an external bodily sheath, our individuality, which at birth comes down from divine spiritual heights, and returns to divine spiritual heights at death, is exposed to the pain of existence, to the sorrow of existence. In reality, there is only one salvation for men, expressed in the four great holy truths of Buddha, for that is, to become free from external existence, to throw off the external sheath. That means so to transform the individuality that it comes, as soon as possible, into the condition in which it can throw off what is the external sheath. We note here that a feeling is active, the reverse of that which the Greeks experienced. Just as strongly as the Greek had loved and valued the external bodily sheath and had felt the sadness of casting it aside, just so feebly did the adherent of Buddhism value this physical sheath, considering it as that which must be cast aside as quickly as possible. With this principle was associated the battle against craving after existence, that is, after an existence enshrouded by an external bodily sheath. Let us go a little more deeply into these thoughts of Buddha. A kind of theoretical view meets us in Buddhism concerning the successive incarnations of man. It is less a question of what the individual thinks about the theory of Buddha than of that which penetrated into the consciousness of the adherents of Buddhism. I have already often mentioned this. I have said that we have perhaps no better opportunity of feeling what an adherent of Buddhism must have felt in regard to the continuous incarnations of man than when we plunge ourselves in thought into that conversation which has been handed down to us as the conversation of King Milinda with a Buddhist sage. Quote, "Thou hast come in thy carriage, then reflect, O great king," close quote, said the sage Nagasena, continue quote, "that all that thou hast before thee in the carriage is nothing else than the wheels, the shaft, the body of the carriage, the seat, and beyond these nothing else exists except a word which includes wheels, shaft, body of the carriage, seat, etc. Thus thou canst not speak of a special individuality of the carriage, but thou must clearly understand that carriage is an empty word when thou thinkest of anything else than its parts, its members." Close quote. And another simile was chosen by Nagasena, the sage, to give to King Milinda, quote, "Consider the almond fruit which grows on the tree, and reflect that out of another fruit a seed was taken and was laid in the earth and decayed. Out of that seed the tree has grown, and upon it the fruit. Canst thou say that the fruit upon the tree has anything else in common, other than name and external form, with the fruit from which the seed was taken, laid in the earth, and there decayed?" Close quote. A man, Nagasena meant to say, has just as much in common with the man of his preceding incarnation as the almond fruit on the tree has with the almond fruit which as seed was laid in the earth. He who believes that that which stands before us as man, and which is wafted away by death, is anything else than name and form, believes something as false as he who thinks that in the carriage, in the name carriage, something else is contained than the parts of the carriage, the wheels, shaft, etc. From the preceding incarnation, nothing passes over into the new incarnation of what man calls his ego. This is important. And we must continually emphasize the fact that it is not to the point how this person or that chooses to interpret this or the other saying of Buddha, but how Buddhism worked in the consciousness of the people, what it gave to their souls. And what it gave to their souls is indeed expressed with intense clearness and significance in this parable, which has come down to us from King Milinda and the Buddhist sage. Of what we call the ego, and of which we say that it is first felt and perceived by man when he reflects upon his inner being, the Buddhist says that really it is something that flows into him, and which belongs to Maya as much as all else, something that does not go from incarnation to incarnation. I have elsewhere mentioned that if a Christian sage were to be compared with the Buddhist one, he would have spoken differently to King Milinda. The Buddhist said to the king, quote, "Consider the carriage, wheels, shaft, etc. They are parts of the carriage, and beyond these parts, carriage is only a name and form. With the word carriage, thou hast named nothing real, and in the carriage," let me read that again, "with the word carriage, thou hast named nothing real in the carriage. If thou wilt speak of what is real, thou must name the parts," Close quote. In the same case, the Christian sage would have spoken as follows, quote, O wise King Melinda, thou hast come in thy carriage. Look at it. In it thou canst see only the wheels, the shaft, the body of the carriage, etc. But I ask thee now, canst thou travel hither with the wheels only? Canst thou travel hither with the shaft only, or with the seat only? Thou canst not travel hither on any of the separate parts. So far as they are parts, they make the carriage. But on the parts thou canst not come hither. In order that the parts put together can make the carriage, something else is necessary than there merely being parts. That in the first place is the quite special thought as regards the carriage which brings together wheels, shaft, etc. And the thought of the carriage is something necessary. Thou canst not indeed see the thought, but thou must recognize it. Close quote. And the sage then would turn to man and say, quote, Of the individual person, thou canst see only the external body, the external acts, and the external soul experiences. Thou seest in man just as little of his ego as in the name carriage thou seest its separate parts. Something quite different is established within the parts, namely, that which lets thee travel hither. So also in man, within all his parts, something quite different is established, namely, that which constitutes the ego. The ego is something real, which, as the supersensible part, goes from one incarnation to another. Close quote. How can we make a diagram of the Buddhistic teaching of reincarnation, merely to represent the corresponding Buddhistic theory? With the circle C, we represent a man between birth and death. The man dies. The time when he dies is indicated by the point where the circle C touches the line A to B, and there's a circle, and to the right tangent to it and perpendicular is a line with A and B on the end. In that circle, at C, there's a line that goes straight through, of course, hitting the tangent at the point of tangency, and there's a D at the end of that ray. Sorry, I know that's difficult to understand. Sorry, my aside, that's Dale's aside. Now, what remains over of all that has been shut up within the existence between birth and death? A causal nucleus, the result of acts. Everything remains over that a man has done, good or bad, beautiful or ugly, clever or stupid. What remains over works further as cause and forms the causal nucleus for the next incarnation. Around this causal nucleus, there attach themselves, during the next incarnation, new body sheaths. These body sheaths go through new experiences, as did the body sheaths around the earlier causal nucleus. From these experiences in D, there remains again a causal nucleus. The causal nucleus, which includes those experiences which have come into it from earlier incarnations, together with those experiences gained independently during incarnation D, is the causal nucleus for the next incarnation, and so on. That is, that which goes through the incarnations exhausts itself in causes and effects, which, without the incarnations being connected by a common ego, work over from one incarnation to another. So, when in this incarnation I call myself an ego, that is not because the same ego was also in the preceding incarnation. From the preceding incarnation, only what is present, which is karmic result, and what I call my ego, is only a maya of the present incarnation. He who really knows Buddhism must picture it in this way. and he must clearly understand that what we call the ego has no place in Buddhism. Now let us pass on to that which we know through theosophical cognition. How has man been able to develop his ego at all? Through the earth evolution. Only in the course of the earth evolution has man attained to the development of his ego. His ego was added to his physical body, etheric body, and astral body on the earth. Now, when we remember all that had to be said concerning the evolutionary phases of man during the Saturn, Sun, and Moon periods, we know that during the Moon period, the human physical body had not as yet a quite settled form, but that it received this form first upon the earth. Consequently, we speak of the earth existence as that epoch in which the, quote, spirits of form, close quote, first took part, and so metamorphosed the physical body of man that it has its present form. This forming of the human physical body was necessary so that the ego could find a place in man, necessary so that that which was formed as physical earth body, confronting the physical earth, offered the foundation for the dawn of the ego as we know it. When we think of this, what follows will no longer seem incomprehensible. In reference to the value attached to the ego by the Greeks, we have said that this ego finds its external expression in the external human form. Let us now transfer our thoughts to Buddhism and remember that Buddhism, according to its knowledge, wills to overcome and cast away as quickly as possible the external form of the human physical body. Can we then wonder that in Buddhism we find no value attached to that which is connected with this form of the physical body? By the innermost kernel of Buddhism, the external form of the physical body is valued as little as the external form is valued which the ego needs in order to come into being. Let me read that again. By the innermost kernel of Buddhism, the external form of the physical body is valued as little as the external form is valued which the ego needs in order to come into being. Indeed, it is completely put aside. Buddhism lost the form of the ego through the way in which it undervalued the physical body. Thus we see how these two spiritual currents are polarically opposed. The Greek current, which set the highest value on the external form of the physical body as the external form of the ego, and Buddhism, which requires that the external form of the physical body with all craving after existence shall be overcome as soon as possible, and which consequently in its theory has completely lost the ego. Between these two opposite world philosophies stand ancient Hebraism. Ancient Hebraism is far from thinking so slightingly of the ego as does Buddhism. In Buddhism, it is heresy to recognize a continuous ego going on from one incarnation to the next. But ancient Hebraism held very strongly to this so-called heresy. And it would never have entered the mind of an adherent of that religion to think that that which lives in man as his personal divine spark with which he connected his concept of the ego is lost when the person goes through the gate of death. If we want to make clear how the ancient Hebrew regarded the matter, we must say that he felt himself connected in his inner being with the Godhead, intimately connected. He knew that he was bound with the strongest threads of his soul life to the nature of this Godhead. In reference to the concept of the ego, the ancient Hebrew was quite different from the Buddhist. But in another respect, he was also very different from the Greek. When we survey those ancient times as a whole, we find that the estimation of the personality, and as a consequence, the appreciation of the external human form, which was peculiar to the Greek, is not present in ancient Hebraism. For the Greek it would have been absolute nonsense to say, quote, "Thou shalt make no image for thyself of thy God," close quote. He would not have understood if someone had said to him, quote, "Thou shalt not make to thyself any image of thy Zeus or thy Apollo," close quote. A Greek had the feeling that the highest thing was the external form, and that the highest tribute that a man could offer to the gods was to clothe them with this human form, which he himself valued so much. Nothing would have been more absurd for him than the command, quote, "Thou shalt make for thyself no image of God," close quote. As artist, the Greek gave his human form to his gods, in order actually to become that which he considered himself, a likeness of the Godhead. He carried out his wrestling, his gymnastics, etc., so that he could become a real copy of the God. But the ancient Hebrew had the commandment, quote, "Thou shalt make for thyself no image of God," close quote. And for this reason, the Hebrew did not esteem the external form as did the Greek. He would have considered it unworthy in reference to the divine being. The ancient Hebrew was so far removed, on the one side, from the disciple of Buddhism, who would have much preferred wholly to cast off the human form on passing through death, as he was, on the other side, from the Greek. He was mindful of the fact that it was just this form that brought to expression what the commands, the laws of the divine being are. And he clearly understood that he, who was a, quote, "righteous man," close quote, handed down to and through the following generations what he, as a righteous man, had gathered together. Not the extinguishing of the form, but the handing on of the form through the generations was what stood before the eyes of the ancient Hebrew. His idea stood midway between the view of the Buddhist, who had lost the value of the ego, and the Greek, who saw in the form of the body the very highest, and who felt it as something sorrowful when the bodily form had to disappear with death. So these three views stand over against one another, and the better to understand ancient Hebraism, we must make it clear that to the Hebrew, that which he valued as his ego was in a certain sense at the same time the divine ego. The God lived on in humanity, lived within man. In his union with the God, the Hebrew felt at the same time his own ego. The ego was such that he felt it coincident with the divine ego. The divine ego sustained him. The divine ego was also active within him. The Greek said, quote, "I value my ego so greatly that I look with horror upon what will happen to it after death," close quote. The Buddhist said, quote, "That which is the cause of the external form of man must fall away from man as soon as possible," close quote. The Hebrew said, quote, "I am united with God. That is my fate. And so long as I am united with him, I bear my fate. I know nothing else than the identity of my ego and the divine ego," close quote. In this mode of thought in ancient Judaism, standing as it does midway between Greek thought and Buddhism, there does not lie, as in Greek thought itself, from the very outset, the predisposition to tragedy in face of the phenomenon of death. But this tragedy lies indirectly in it. It is truly Greek for the hero Achilles to say, quote, "Better a beggar in the upper world," close quote, that is, with the human bodily form, quote, "than a king in the realm of shades," close quote. But a Hebrew could not have said this without something more. For the Hebrew knows that when in death his bodily form falls away, he remains united with God. He cannot simply, through the fact of death, fall into a tragic mood. Still, indirectly, the predisposition to tragedy is present in ancient Hebraism, and is expressed in the most wonderfully dramatic story ever written in ancient times, the story of Job. There we see how the ego of Job feels bound up with his God, how it comes into conflict with his God. But in another way, then the Greek ego comes into conflict. We are shown how misfortune after misfortune falls upon Job, although he is conscious that he is a righteous man, and has done all that can maintain the connection of his ego with the divine ego. And while he sees that his existence is blessed and ought to be blessed, tragic fate breaks over him. Job is not conscious of any sin. He is conscious that he has acted as a righteous man must act toward his God. Word is brought to him that all his possessions have been destroyed, all his family slain. Then his external body, this divine form, is stricken with grievous disease, most miserable. There he stands. He was conscious that, quote, that which in me is connected with my God has striven to be righteous before my God. My fate, decreed to me by this God, has placed me in the world. It is the acts of this God which have fallen so heavily upon me. Close quote. And his wife stands there beside him and calls upon him in strange words to deny his God. These words are handed down correctly. What his wife says in one of those sayings which correspond exactly with the Akashic record, quote, renounce thy God, since thou must suffer so much, since he has brought these sufferings upon thee, and die, close quote. What infinite depth lies in these words, quote, lose the consciousness of the connection with thy God. Then thou fallest out of the divine connection, thou fallest like a leaf from the tree, and thy God can no longer punish thee. Close quote. The loss of the connection with God is at the same time death. For as long as the ego feels itself connected with God, death cannot touch it. The ego must tear itself off from connection with God. Then only can death touch it. According to outward appearance, everything really is against righteous Job. His wife sees the suffering and advises him to renounce God and die. His friends come and say, quote, you must have done this or that, for God punishes no righteous man. Close quote. But he is aware, that is, as far as his personal consciousness is concerned, that he has done nothing unrighteous. Through what meets him in the external world, he stands before an immense tragedy, before the tragedy of not being able to understand human existence, the feeling one's self bound up with God, and the not understanding how that which he is experiencing can have its source in God. Let us think of that as lying with its full weight upon a human soul. Let us think of this soul breaking forth into the words which have come down to us from this traditional story of Job. Quote, I know that my Redeemer liveth. I know that one day I shall again be clothed with my bones, with my skin, and that I shall look upon God, with whom I am united. Close quote. This consciousness of the indestructibility of the human individuality breaks forth from the soul of Job in spite of all pain and all suffering. So powerful is the consciousness of the ego as the innermost content of the ancient Hebrew belief. But we meet here with something else in the highest degree remarkable. Quote, I know that my Redeemer liveth. Close quote, says Job. Quote, I know that one day I shall again be covered with my skin, and that with mine eyes I shall behold the glory of my God. Close quote. Job brings into connection with the Redeemer thought the external body, skin and bones, eyes which see physically. Strange. Suddenly in this consciousness which stands midway between Greek thought and Buddhism, this ancient Hebrew consciousness, we meet the consciousness of the significance of the physical bodily form in connection with the Redeemer thought, which thereupon becomes the foundation, the basis for the Christ thought. And when we take the answer of the wife of Job, still more light falls on the whole of what Job says, quote, "Renounce thy God and die," close quote. That is to say, he who does not renounce his God does not die. That is implied in these words. But then, what does die mean? To die means to throw off the physical body. External Maya seems to say that the physical body passes over into the elements of the earth and, so to speak, disappears. Thus, in the answer of Job's wife, there lies the following, quote, "Do what is necessary that thy physical body may disappear," close quote. It could not mean anything else. Otherwise, the words of Job that follow would have no sense. For man can only understand anything if he can understand that through which God has placed us in the world, if he can understand the significance of the physical body. And Job himself says, for this too lies in his words, quote, "Oh, I know full well that I do not need to do what will cause the complete disappearance of my physical body, which only presents external appearance. There is a possibility that it may be saved, because my Redeemer liveth. This I cannot express otherwise than in the words, my skin, my bones will one day be recreated. With my eyes I shall behold the glory of my God. I can lawfully keep my physical body, but for this I must have the consciousness that my Redeemer liveth." Close quote. And so in this story of Job, there comes before us for the first time a connection between the form of the physical body, which the Buddhist would strip off, which the Greek sees pass away with sadness, and the ego consciousness. We meet for the first time with something like a prospect of the deliverance of that which the host of gods from ancient Saturn, Sun, and Moon, down to the earth itself, had brought forth as the form of the physical body. A prospect which makes it necessary if the form is to be preserved, if we are to say of it that what has been given us of bones, skin, and sense organs is not to pass away, that we should add, quote, "I know that my Redeemer liveth," close quote. After what has just been said, someone might ask the question, quote, "It is strange. Does it really follow from the story of Job that Christ awakens the dead and rescues the bodily form which the Greeks believe would disappear? And is there perhaps anything in that story to show that, as regards the collective development of humanity, it is not correct, in the full sense of the word, to hold that the external bodily form entirely disappears, but that we should rather hold that this bodily form is interwoven with the whole process of human evolution? Does this connection play a part in the future? Does it depend upon the Christ being?" Close quote. This question is set us. And here we come to the fact that we must, in a certain way, widen what we have so far heard in Theosophy. We hear that when we pass through the gate of death, we retain at least the etheric body, but we strip off the physical body entirely. We see it externally delivered up to the elements, but its form, upon which work has been expended through millions and millions of years, is that lost in nothingness? Or is it in a certain way retained? We shall consider this question as the outcome of the explanations given today. And in the next lecture, we shall approach it as follows. In what relation does the impulse of the Christ for human evolution stand to the significance of the external physical body, which throughout the whole earth evolution is consigned to the grave, to the fire, or to the air, and the preservation of which, as regards its form, is necessary for the future of humanity. The end of Lecture 5.